the next generation of QD OLED or emissive QD. So you actually electrically pump the quantum dots rather than pump them with blue light. The question now, I think, is really, can anybody make a business case out of that? And with LCD, you can just keep squeezing that cost. And that, I think, is the problem for OLED. The science is there to do it. The question is now, is it a good business case?
Hello and welcome to the AV Forums TV Display and Calibration Podcast for the 8th of July. And on this edition, there's only two of us this week, but I'm joined by Paul Gray, who's the Research Director, Consumer Devices from the consultancy and research firm Omdia. Hi, Paul. Great to see you.
Good to be back, Phil.
It's been a little while. We were just discussing off air the last time you were on the podcast. I think everybody's in for a good time this afternoon in terms of finding out about the TV industry, because that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the current state of the TV market. We're going to look at the trends, consumer buying habits, big screen TVs, new trends, that kind of thing. So if that's what you're into, then stay tuned. That conversation is coming up with Paul very shortly. But first of all, I just need to quickly go through a little bit of housekeeping. And if you are watching us on video, but you'd rather watch or listen to the audio-only version, you can do that on any of the podcast providers out there. Or if you want to watch this on YouTube, then you can head to our YouTube channel for the podcast, which is AV Forums Podcasts. That's different from the main channel, so it's AV Forums Podcasts. If you go and subscribe to that channel, you'll never miss any of our podcasts. And they come out every Monday at 7 p.m. on the YouTube channel, and then a little bit later as audio only. So it's every Monday for our podcast. And of course, if you like the content, if you like the podcast, if you think what we're talking about is interesting and deserves a bit of a wider audience, then please do feel free to share this podcast on any of your social channels or forums or anything that you frequent, and let people know about us and let them come and join us here. And who are we? Well, we're AV Forums. We've been around since 2000, and the editorial's been around since 2003. And I'm Phil Hinton. I'm the editor of the site, and I have been for 20 odd years now. So you'll know me from some of the videos if you frequent the site. I write a lot of the TV reviews, and it's TV that we're talking about this afternoon. I'm also a trained and certified calibrator by ISF, THX, and PVA. So yeah, that's me. Who's Paul? Paul, tell us all about yourself. What do you do?
So I'm a research director for consumer electronics at Omdia, and we are a industry research company, and our job and our passion is tracking consumer electronics. In particular, we're very, very strong in TV, and we have a group of six analysts all around the world talking to the people who matter, understanding the supply chains, understanding consumer demand, and everything that goes on in between.
Yeah. So, I mean, we cross paths quite a bit, and people might ask why that happens. Well, it's been a little while, but usually it's a manufacturer's launch event. They will call you in to discuss certain areas of the market that they are maybe aiming at. So how involved are you with actual TV manufacturers and producers? How involved do they get with your research?
Well, first of all, there are clients, and we work very, very closely with them because they're also our sources for data and information. And so we're talking to them on a daily basis about what they're doing, what's succeeding, what isn't succeeding, what new products are coming out, what people think about what's going on in the market. So if, for example, standards are changing and what they're going to do about it. So yeah, we have a day-to-day relationship with them. But also, of course, it's a supply chain. So we talk very closely to panel makers and chip makers. These people have to invest huge amounts of money, much, much more than TV makers. And so they plan much, much further ahead. So one of our key jobs is forecasting. So we also talk to the other people in the supply chain. And beyond that, there are people who make materials and equipment, and they want to understand the market. And then finally, if you're going to build an LCD fab, you're going to need to borrow about $7 billion. So amongst our clients are also banks and hedge funds who will be involved in actually financing this whole industry.
It's interesting that's what you cover, because I think there's lots of things that we can deep dive there and find out a little bit more from Us as consumers, and even myself as a reviewer, we don't tend to get access to this kind of data or the trends. We just see it from our point of view, and certainly from the point of view of myself being around for 20 years covering TVs and so on. One of the things that I think I've found is that, or certainly one of the preconceptions I have, is that there's not much money in this industry because it's really quite a mature industry, and people don't tend to change the product that often.
Right. Yeah, in that respect, it's a really tough business to make money in. So typically companies are probably making 2 or 3% margin. However, it's also a very stable business. So it's, around about 200 million TVs a year get shipped. And for most people in most countries, then a TV is one of those things that they won't do without. So yeah, it's a really, really tough business. There's definitely a belief that, one day everybody will make lots of money in TV. You just got to wait a bit and hang in there. But it's a stable one. It's a source of revenue, and it's an interesting business because it manages to reinvent itself so often. But yeah, people probably replace their TV about every 8 years, something like that. It was a bit briefer, maybe 10 years ago when panel sizes were getting much, much bigger, very, very quickly as the LCD industry was making panels grew very rapidly. Yeah, it's a stable, mature business now.
It's interesting you said reinventing itself because it tends to come in cycles, doesn't it? Because 2 years ago we were talking about OLED taking over the world as a display tech, and this year we're talking about mini LED again, and a lot of manufacturers are actually backing that horse this year in terms of larger screen sizes, which seems to be a trend at the minute. They can obviously source the panels cheaper. Which gives them a little bit more room for margin and so on. So are you actually seeing that as well?
We were always very, very cautious about OLED, and our forecasts were always that OLED was going to be a treat, really, because you were going to have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to actually replace all that LCD capacity, and there really wasn't a business case for that. Western Europe is a little bit different, a little bit special, because consumers in Western Europe valued OLED far more than consumers in other regions. Europe, Western Europe and Japan, in fairness. But very definitely the tectonic plates have shifted, if you like, in the industry. The biggest problem is for OLED is that it's very, very hard to take cost out of OLED panels. Very, very hard. And at the same time, the Chinese in 2016, 2017 started investing in a new generation of LCD fabs to make incredible sizes of LCD panels. And at that stage, the Chinese TV market was 60 million units a year. Well, it's in the low 40s now. Chinese consumers have really shifted their spending away from phones and TVs and things like that in recent years. Even before the pandemic. And as a result, all that huge amount of capacity was very, very underloaded. And so one of the things that we've seen now is a huge surge in screen sizes. The Chinese panel makers have, in the bigger scheme of thing, you can say they've won. Samsung and LG are basically more or less out of making LCD panels now. And so it's a Chinese industry, and the Chinese brands sense their moment at the same time that they're fighting on a level playing field. And in fact, they've all got home local suppliers now. And as a result, they're now playing to their strengths, which is local LCD supply, readily available. And so you can go big. And Samsung and LG, if you think about this game, they're playing with exactly the same panels that are bought from exactly the same suppliers. So it's a really, really intense battle. And suddenly you see, yeah, this 85 inch last year, 100 inch this year, even 115 inch now. And it's going to be really exciting to see what consumers think about that. How much more furniture are you going to move? Will it just be in China and North America, or will it become significant in Western Europe?
It is an interesting problem, and it's certainly an area where I think manufacturers feel they can make money, certainly from my point of view in terms of what I see with the TV market and reviewing and so on. It's very much mid-range to high-end, where they are putting a lot of the R&D in. And then, like you say, the Chinese brands like TCL and Hisense are really pushing the larger panel sizes. And it's TCL's thing this year where they're pushing 115 inch. And I've had the opportunity to spend some time with that, measure it and put it through its paces. And that is a genuine replacement for a projector in the home. And if you can fit something like that, it kind of it adds up a new market, especially if you can then take advantage of HDR and other things where projectors really struggle. A projector will maybe do 60 to 100 nits, whereas you're getting these panels that they can push out 5,000 nits of specular peak brightness. That's a big difference under direct view, so you get the brightness as well from that. It's not a reflective technology.
Right, yeah. Unfortunately for projection, nobody's invented black light yet. It's an interesting one. We did a major study of consumers and in custom installers in the US and China at the end of last year. And the fascinating thing is we'd assumed, just like you've said, that people were putting in these very, very large direct view panels to replace projection. And when we did the research with the custom installers and consumers in the US, the place where they said they were putting these 100-inch TVs was bedrooms.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know anybody who isn't surprised by that. It's quite incredible. And I think for projection, it looks like it may be a little bit of a different market, that people want that feeling of being in the cinema. And if you've got a dedicated room and you painted the walls black and things like that, and you've mocked it up with some secondhand cinema seats and things like that, then it's probably a slightly different thing. It's a bit like listening to vinyl records. So there's a ritual to go with it and an experience. But yeah, definitely consumers are really surprising as to what they're doing with these TVs. And of course, these are not trivial things to go and install. If you look at the box, it's the size of a queen size mattress or bigger. And probably it has to be delivered to your home rather than you take it home yourself. And probably you want to wall mount it because they're very heavy. And certainly, I think if you had a home with small kids, you'd be worried about what would happen if it toppled over. So it's a very different market. It's almost like buying a freezer or a fridge, or a
Yeah.
washing machine. It's big and heavy.
So I guess, Paul, the obvious question that we're not asking there is, are there consumers out there that want to buy these large screens? Because as enthusiasts, we can say, oh, well, as long as the wife agrees or the partner agrees to having this in the house, it would be great to have that. But actually, normal consumers, the wider market, do they actually want large screens?
I've been consistently wrong about screen size over the years, so I'm going to, eat my humble pie now and say that consumers have always surprised me about the space they will make. Sooner or later, of course, you end up at the point where you hit the housing stock. And North America, I think, is totally fine. Probably, actually, you'll find that in the US, it will be away from the coastal areas because land tends to be cheaper and housing tends to be larger. Probably you won't find so many people in, say, New York City will have 100-inch because people, many more live in apartments and it's difficult getting into the elevator and things like that just to install it. Likewise, in the UK, so many of our houses were built before 1930 and they've got a typical sort of 12-foot by 12-foot room with a chimney in the middle of it. On one wall, and you have to push the TV into the corner. And 100-inch TV, it's going to kind of block off half the room. So I think we'll see that people start bumping up against the housing stock and room sizes and things like that. But very definitely, for example, in China, then it's the norm to, or even South Korea, it's the norm to have a rectangular room that really isn't very large. It's a similar sort of size as European standards, and one wall is TV. And consumers are quite happy with that. So I think there's room to be surprised, provided you've got a house built after about 1960. And I wouldn't be surprised if our forecast is too low.
Okay.
Consumers seem so happy about it. I think the thing that worries me more is how much you can go before the quality of delivery becomes a problem. So watching an SD channel on Freeview, then yeah, for me that's okay on my 55-inch TV. I probably wouldn't want to go to 75-inch because if you're watching a lot of that, content in SD, it just looks terrible on a highly compressed channel. And so I think at that stage you also hit some national norms in terms of what the broadcasters are up to or how people are consuming content.
So th let's focus in on a few areas and maybe deep dive a little bit. So let's actually look at the technical trends at the minute. So we discussed OLED, many of these kind of making a bit of a comeback this year. You've got some big brands getting behind it. I mean, Sony have some great tech this year in terms of the backlight drive that they're using in the Bravia 9 and Bravia 7 TVs. We're seeing Samsung pushing, continuing to push that technology. And of course, you've got Hisense and TCL who are basing much of their product on that. So what are you actually seeing in the market with your research when it comes to the technical stuff?
Yeah, definitely. We've definitely got that move that people are hedging their bets on OLED. Even the big brands have committed, huge amounts of money to OLED, like LG and Samsung. Then they also know that they have to make sure that they've got alternatives because the big advantage about LCD is you can change one part of the system without changing all the rest of the system. So you can keep the LCD cell the same and you can change the backlight on its own. And that freedom of whereas in OLED you've got to go back to the lab and redesign the whole thing. And at the same time, the mini LED technology and the pick and place technologies that go to assemble those things are evolving very, very rapidly. And so I think brands at the moment sense an opportunity to do something different. We've always maintained that you can make an LCD look every bit as good as an OLED. It's slightly different. You can make it brighter, but you probably can't get the black levels. So if you watch in a brightly lit white room, the LCD will look better. If you watch in the dark, the OLED will look better. Then it's not better or worse. They're just different experiences. And people are certainly looking to see what you can do with that. And the LCD panels are being sold only just above cost. Panel prices have gone up a lot, but they're still relatively cheap. And so people are taking advantage of that and really seeing what they can squeeze out of the backlight technology. It's evolving fast. I think we've got another 2 or 3 years of rapid evolution in those backlights to go. There's quite a lot more that you can do. And working out what the market expects and the cost and things like that, I think everybody's trying to find out at the moment. The TCL's got 2,000 plus zones on their backlight, phenomenal investment, great level of complexity. Is that what the market really wants, or does it settle at about 500 or 200? I think nobody quite knows at the moment. And OLED was a kind of all-in technology. It was or it wasn't, and you couldn't have half the sort of performance. Personally, I really hope we end up with lots of zones because it just looks great. And I think that HDR content done well looks absolutely fantastic.
And of course, the development of OLED was back in the days of SDR content, and 4K was seen as as the premium resolution, and things changed very, very quickly. And OLED has had to try and keep up with the changes and development. So do you see OLED pushing further, or have we plateaued with that technology? Do you think that technology can be pushed a little bit further?
I think we continue to see LG Display come out with new tricks, so the micro lens system and things like that. So there's room to do it. I think the part of the reason that we saw, for example, the move to 8K was deliberate moves by competitors to make life difficult for OLED. And you remember all the way back, you know, when we had plasma, was that it's very, very hard to increase resolution on emissive displays. Emissive displays do a lot of things really well, but high resolution is really hard for them, because what goes into the display has to come out. You know, you put the energy in to turn it into light and get it out. LCD's not like that. It's just a shutter system. So you can stuff more energy in the back of the panel and something will come out the front. So that's been the problem. There are more tricks in OLED. I think Samsung's QD emissive system had, you know, looked like it broke the mold a bit. You know, the super intense saturated colors. The SID display show in San Jose last month, then we were seeing the next generation of QD OLED or emissive QD. So you actually electrically pump the quantum dots rather than pump them with blue light. The question now, I think, is really, can anybody make a business case out of that? And with LCD, you can just keep squeezing that cost. Mm. And that, I think, is the problem for OLED. The science is there to do it. The question is now, is it a good business case?
And it's interesting that TCL, even though they've invested heavily in their LCD fabs, there's also inkjet OLED, which you know, they are talking about that investment this year, production probably 2 years away as well. So they're not just concentrating on LCD.
No, and I think the other thing that we have to remember is that TV is the toughest display business, because it's very big, and you know, in terms of area of the displays, and at the same time, the pricing is terrible. You know, if you're going to make sheets of glass and process them into displays, you're much better off doing it in phones or PCs or especially these days automotive. And so TCL's investments may not end up in TV, in the same way that Samsung, with its conventional OLED business, is the absolute runaway market leader. But you don't see them in TV in that conventional OLED technology. So TCL's investments may get directed elsewhere, and I think that's actually most likely.
Yeah, and of course the elephant in the room, we've been talking about it for a number of years now, and I still think we're going to be talking about it for quite a few years yet, and that's micro LED.
Yes.
Very, very promising technology. I love it every time I see it. It blows me away every time I see it. But it's getting the yield size, and that seems to be the real issue with that. So I think I said 5 to 10 years, even from now. Where are you seeing things with your research and how you see things developing?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it will happen in other applications first again. It is ultimately now a process engineering problem and a manufacturing systems problem. I've seen some really impressive demonstrations now where you use a lot of machine vision as well. So you start off with all the LEDs on the wafer die, and you test them on the wafer, and you know where the dud ones are. And you then pick and place them, but you only transfer the good ones. You then retest, and then you do a final stage where you pick and place a patch, which is from the dud ones when you started and the dud ones after the test, and you patch that. And it's done in a single repair stage, and it's all automated. And those sort of things with mass transfer are the way that it's definitely going to go. Yeah, I wouldn't expect anything quickly. It will start off in other applications, and above all, applications where people are prepared to pay a lot of extra money for that kind of display. And I think this is the thing to remember in this industry. For a technology to break out, it has to have that killer solution where people will pay a lot of money for it.
Yeah.
And that takes it from the science lab into a high volume product. LCD bumped around for a long time until people invented notebook PCs. And in the mid-90s, when you were making 4-up 11-inch notebook PC screens on a sheet of glass about this big, at $1,200 a screen, that was what took LCD from the science lab into another mass market product. But even when it was in mass market, it took 10 years to get that into TVs. So no, I agree with you, 5 to 10 years.
And in terms of micro LED, I mean, we'll see it in other applications. Are you thinking commercial applications in terms of screen rolls, that kind of thing, or smaller devices? Where do you see that happening?
For micro LED, I think we'll see it in things like near eye applications, smartwatches, and things like that are the obvious ones, where also they can be shorter lived devices. You know, the TV's got to last for 8 years. As well, so that's really tough. In terms of the bigger applications, like as you say, for commercial ones like video walls and things like that, actually most of the time you don't need the LEDs to be that small. People have had mini LED video wall solutions, so less than 1 millimeter, typically 0.9 pitch, for 5 years. And the only problem was that nobody actually wanted to use it because the resolution was so high, and most of the time, if it's that big a screen, you're miles away from it. So it was a sort of an excessive technology, a bit like 8K in TV, if you like. So I think we'll see a lot more in near eye, wearable portable devices, first of all, and auto. You know, again, we'll see more in auto.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we move on to the what the consumer is actually buying at the minute and so on. You just mentioned 8K. Is it dead? Is that technology gone? Is it buried?
I mean, it can always come back. You know, there's nothing that means that you have to abandon it and never bring it back. We certainly are seeing that the numbers are going down, and last quarter was about 65,000 8K TV shipped worldwide. So probably it'll be under half. You know, I think we can be pretty confident it'll be under 500,000 8K TVs worldwide this year. Why? Shortage of content. You know, it's really, really hard to find 8K content.
I guess it was a there was other issues as well, though, Paul, wasn't it? Sometimes people don't realize this, but EU regulations overpower when you're talking about an LCD TV where you've got the backlight and then you've got all these tens of millions of pixels that have to be in the way of that light. You need a lot more light to get the same amount of light through as a 4K TV. So that was automatically up against a lot of manufacturers in terms of how they were going to be able to produce these TVs.
It also made it much more expensive. You know, to do 8K, you needed a really powerful backlight and a bigger power supply. And then because of those things, you needed more cooling. And you needed more memory to process it. So all those things added a lot of cost. If you're an EU lawmaker, you probably realize that you hadn't really quite constructed it very well because the regulation was about out-of-box condition. And I know there are videos around where I've discussed this with people and shown that, you know, you get a warning and then you just crank the brightness up. So I don't, you know, in back in the real world, I don't think it really stopped the industry doing what it wanted to. I think the bigger problem was that there was a lot more cost in those TVs if you wanted to make them look good, and there was a shortage of things to do with them.
So let's move on to what the actual consumers are buying, because we're enthusiasts. We love talking about this technology. We love seeing the demos and getting the new kit in to play with. And sometimes as a reviewer, I'll kind of lose touch a little bit with, the actual consumer out there, the mass consumer, and what they're actually looking for in a TV. We can talk about picture accuracy and all stuff till the cows come home, but it's what the actual consumer's buying. So let's have a look at that. What are the trends at the minute when it comes to buying TVs? Are people buying TVs, or is it just a replacement purchase these days for the majority?
It's very definitely a replacement market. You know, that in Europe and North America, then 90-something% of households have a TV. And when the TV goes pop, they don't listen to the radio, they go and buy a new one. That said, the pandemic, of course, people were stuck at home and home entertainment became much more important, and people did definitely invest more in home entertainment. So the installed base is a bit young at the moment. We still see the market has little pops. It tends to be by country, and it tends to be around broadcast events. So Italy, a couple of years ago, shifted its broadcasting from DVB-T to DVB-T2, and also at the same time to It shut off the MPEG-2 services, and that bumped the market as people had to replace their TVs. Likewise, at the beginning of this year, there was switch off of standard definition services in Spain, and the TV market had a little bump. In France and Spain this year, then free-to-air terrestrial UHD channels have started, and I think those are giving the markets again a little bump. Behind the scenes, then actually in Europe and most countries in the world, then the number of households with a TV is falling. It's very unclear as to what's happening. There isn't a single explanation, but certainly, we all know that younger consumers just see video as video, and they will watch it on everything. And I think also, of course, we have to remember that younger consumers live more transient lives than certainly I did when I was in my early 20s, because they tend to rent more now. And probably owning a TV is just a pain. If you're constantly moving house, then having a big piece of equipment isn't so attractive. So we certainly see that younger consumers have moved away from TV a certain amount. In terms of the entertainment they're watching, well, it's lots of long-form video, and terrestrial broadcasters are just as important because it's news and soaps and sports events and things like that that people care about. But certainly they mix in their screens much more differently.
Yeah, and again, we see this in other areas of the AV industry, that the hi-fi side of things, that audience is getting older, and it doesn't seem to be the young blood coming in to replace those that are getting older. So are we seeing the same kind of thing with TV, when that everybody's watching on these things, and you just have to look at, take AV forums for example, our site traffic. You look at what devices people are using to visit AV forums. Mobile's massive compared to desktop and smart TV and other forms.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, for example, is that probably product managers and everybody else in the in industry tends to undervalue convenience. And I found myself watching on my phone in front of my TV. Why? Because I picked it up and I just touched it, and that was it. I think the other things with it is that certainly viewing has split and polarized, so that there's a bigger difference now between shared and personal. The TV is still the absolute killer device for shared viewing. You don't want to sit down with your best beloved and watch for 20 minutes or half an hour on a phone, or even on a notebook PC or anything like that. You use the TV for that. However, if you want to watch and catch up, your kind of personal time, which, let's face it, in the world of audio, it's headphones on, or you're in the car on your own, then you might use another screen, and that eats into some of the TVs in the household, and it eats into some of the TV usage. So the BBC published figures, for example, on iPlayer catch-up service usage, that iPlayer peaks about an hour later in the evening compared to peak TV. Peak TV in the UK is about 9 o'clock. Peak iPlayer is about 10 o'clock. And iPlayer also spikes between 9 and 11 o'clock on weekend mornings. And that sounds to me like TV in bed, which may explain the 100-inch one that we joked about earlier on. That's personal viewing. That's me time. I've got a cup of tea. I pull the duvet back over and I catch up on something, or I treat myself. And so I think that you just see that the basic human needs are still there. They're being met in slightly different ways, and we've got a bigger split between shared and personal viewing.
Size matters in the bedroom. That's what we're finding out in our conversation today, Paul. So we are seeing these trends, obviously, and the consumer is they're replacing the TV rather than actually going out and specifically looking at a TV. I think the AV Forums audience is maybe a niche audience, maybe a unique audience, in the fact that our members tend to change their TVs on a more frequent basis. But then you're talking about the higher end sets. You're talking about those sets that are breaking new technology or bringing new technology in, like MLA or QD-OLED and so on. How big is that market actually, when we look at it?
If you look at it, then it is in many ways a decreasing market, but as a really rough, rule of thumb, about 10% of TV shipments worldwide are over $1,000. So it's a pretty small market. So let's say that around about 20 million TVs in the world are for engaged consumers with money to spend, who care enough about the product to research it well, understand the technology, and then ultimately open their wallets and pay for it. And I think what we really see all the time in the TV industry is that pushback between new technologies and who is commanding those premium prices in that $1,000 plus part of the market.
So let's look at some other factors that certainly have made or maybe skewed the results a little bit. You mentioned the pandemic earlier on. I mean, that was a big worldwide event. And like you say, people stuck at home, they looked to home entertainment. But we've had other things that have caused a lot of disruption, a lot of shipping disruption on the back of that. There was the chip crisis, plants closing down and so on. And then, of course, we've got various conflicts around the world, especially Ukraine and so on. So how much of an impact has that all had on this industry? And is it a point where now we're, what, 4, maybe 5 years on now from a lot of these big issues? Has it recovered, or has the recovery been a lot slower than people thought?
I think, well, let's split it down by region. So China, the TV market was falling for some years before the pandemic. And that was a major shift in Chinese consumer behavior. Interestingly, it wasn't related to consumer confidence, although now consumer confidence is an issue in China. So China, there was a systemic shift in what consumers were spending their money on. In emerging countries, then consumers were less protected by their governments, and since the pandemic, they've been rebuilding their finances. And so only now are we seeing people trickle back because they've got the money to spend now, and they've rebuilt their finances. And those markets are recovering. It's at a gradual rate, but they're recovering, and they will provide the growth in the industry in future because they have younger populations and faster growing populations. And in particular, if you look at, let's take one example, Africa, then the moment you see a country electrifies rapidly, then the TV market follows really quickly. So, don't get me wrong, consumers want to buy TVs if they can. That leaves us in Western Europe, where the cost of living crisis over the last 2 or 3 years has hit consumers harder, and of course, demand was depressed after the pandemic because many people bought new TV, and we developed a hypothesis of what consumers would do called revenge consumption, which is they'd go out and spend their money on all the things that they couldn't do during the pandemic, so going on holiday, eating out, and so on, and that certainly happened. Last year was record year for airlines and holidays in Europe. This year certainly started off the year extremely well, and therefore the TV is not at the top of the list. And when people who have less money to spend choose, they'll choose to spend it on a holiday rather than TV. But it's coming back, and it's coming back slowly, but it will happen. And then you've got one country which is totally different to all the others, which is the United States. It dipped a little bit after the pandemic, but today it's above 2019 levels, and it's definitely above 2018 and 2017 levels. And the market just continues to grow, and it's totally different. So one of the things that's happened in the US is that there is a totally different business model for TV developing, which is about ads and data. The US has always been an advertising-driven culture. 40% of all the money spent on advertising in the world is spent in the US to those 330, 350 million people. And now people are marketing TVs solely for the ads and data that TV can present to viewers, and that viewers can then interact with, and also feedback, live audience data, or other live consumer behavior data. So the TV, if you like, is now becoming, in the US, rather like the set-top box was for a pay TV provider. It's there to as a revenue generating device, and they're sold close to cost or even below cost in the US now. And that's why I think the market is still growing. That, you know, there is this battle now for eyeballs between these different TV brands and platforms.
And it's something I go to CES every year. Busman's Holiday, you go and have a look in the local stores to see what is actually being stocked in the US after having to look at all the new stuff on the show floors and so on. And it's one thing that a lot of the traditional brands that we think of have disappeared from that market space. You know, the likes of
Absolutely.
Panasonic have gone, Sony are just clinging on there. And it's the LGs, it's the Samsungs, it's the Hisense and TCLs that are really dominating in that market.
Yeah, and especially also retailer brands. So if you look, for example, at On, which always used to be an Asda name, but when Walmart bought Asda, they took the On brand name and introduced it in the US. Then we see a lot of those white label brands do really, really well in the US. Consumers are much more price sensitive in the US. But now it's waiting regulatory approval, but Walmart is going to buy Vizio. Why? Because Walmart is in a battle against Amazon, and Walmart is going to use its Vizio TVs to put ads in front of consumers. And 220 million people in the US shop at Walmart every month. So that's a way bigger audience for adverts than the Super Bowl. And the advertising business in the US is changing very, very fast. So, you know, Walmart is going to get to the same business that Amazon can do, so it can put adverts in front of them, see what you do as a consumer, because of course you've got a subscription on this one somewhere, or you've got to sign in a login, and then you can do that same thing that Amazon can present things, see what happens to you, what your purchase behavior is, send you a coupon, you click through, and Walmart can do the same thing. So this is a really big change in business model. And TV is, well, what's TV's part in this? You know, is TV going to make money out of this, or is it just sort of getting squashed between these two internet giants? And it's going to be very interesting watching. It probably won't quite happen in Europe because the ad money is less. And the market is much more fragmented. But number two or three countries after that, well, the UK and Germany are pretty interesting markets for similar things. I think what people have to work out is what's to stop a Frenchman seeing a subsidized TV in Germany driving across the border and taking it home. So people have to sort that problem out in Europe. But I think we're seeing a shift away from just making money on TV hardware. That becomes important for us who really care about this business, like you know, enthusiasts. Is that does that mean that the quality end of the TV business begins to wither because people are trying to make their money elsewhere? You know, if you're a car enthusiast and every car's an Uber or a taxi, then it's probably not such an interesting world to live in. And I think that's the risk that we have in the TV business.
And do you see a consumer backlash at this? I mean, you said that, you know, the American market are used to being served adverts, so you just have to switch on American TV, and I think our American viewers don't understand how regulated it is in this country that you can only show so many adverts in a certain period of time every hour. In America, it's very, very different. So do you think there might be a bit of backlash consumer wise if manufacturers then try to serve you ads on your £3,500 TV that you've just purchased and you think, I've spent all this money, why are you still trying to get money out of me?
Yeah, and you just have a feeling that, hang on, this is my TV. This isn't your TV. So I think it's a very, very precarious game, and the scope of misjudging it and getting it badly wrong is it's a high risk. It's a very high risk strategy, and I think the other point to make is that this doesn't work everywhere. So just to give an example, an extreme example is China, where advertising and TV itself are very heavily regulated by the government. Actually, that advertising business moved elsewhere. It moved onto smartphones in China. And TikTok makes something over $20 billion a year out of advertising on smartphones through all sorts of videos and paid services and so on. So you squeeze the balloon and it pops out somewhere else. But no, I think your point about backlash is very true, and you have to you run the risk of really, really alienating your consumers.
And in terms of what the consumers are actually viewing, other than adverts being served to them by their TVs, what are the viewing trends these days? Because it's interesting, I've just had two Hisense TVs come through with Freely on board, which is a new approach from the BBC ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, and UK TV. You don't need an aerial now. You can plug your TV in, connect it to your router, and away you go. And we've seen Sky Stream, so that's moving away from satellite broadcasting. You can consume that differently. And of course, you've got all the streaming services, the video on demand services, and YouTube and everything else. And for me, I taught you this up the other week because I thought it was an interesting point to bring up. I actually watch more YouTube than I do linear TV. In fact, I can't remember the last time I watched live TV for anything other than maybe a big sports event or a big national event. Is that seen elsewhere? Is that a trend?
We've got to be careful because, as you said right at the beginning of the chat, Phil, that we are a really strange bunch of people because we're all enthusiasts and we're all passionate about it, and above all, we're early adopters of technology. But looking at consumers overall, then in the UK, only about 40% of viewing hours now are live linear TV. EastEnders in the evening, every night, and the news at 6 o'clock or whatever, so or live sport. So only about 40% of viewing is live linear TV. Viewing came down a little bit since the pandemic. There's a lot of streaming going on. A lot of it is actually looks pretty much like live linear because it is just time shifted, within the same day. Like, well, I want to go and walk the dog now, so I'll watch EastEnders at a little bit 20 minutes later because. Or, the postman's just come. I've got to stop. I'll pause it and I'll just catch up with it by switching on iPlayer or whatever. I think also, if you look at Freely, then they've just said, well, consumers want to be unaware of the technology. Why should you care about whether you've got an antenna on your roof or a Sky Dish or cable or whatever? People just want to watch content, and Freely allows that to be totally transportable. So you start off on the TV and you then catch up the rest of the series as you sit on the train. And I think Freely's really got the right idea. The thing that you will therefore see is a total separation of delivery technology from services. The UK was very early at working that one out. When you saw broadcasters separate out transmission infrastructure from that. And then what do you do? Well, one option is you double down on the technology. And you saw the US do that with ATSC3. You've seen it in Japan with an 8K channel. And at the same time, in other countries, then they say, no, you can see a world beyond broadcast. Even 15 years ago, Belgium, parts of Belgium, they said, we'll turn it off. And we'll deliver it all through cable or IP. And I think the UK is at a pivot point. Probably in the US, actually has happened without anybody noticing, and it's more and more just moved to streaming. And back to your point about YouTube, then we just live in a world of a phenomenal number of channels. So if you look on streaming, there's this thing that in the industry is called FAST, which is free ad-supported streaming television. And that's all those channels on, for example, Pluto TV, Rakuten. And in the US now, there are about 2,700 channels of this. And a lot of it is linear. So it's maybe not coming from a transmitter in the air, but it's live and linear. The difference is that you can insert ads and you can target ads to people because you know where they are. Because you're streaming to them and you can get an IP address and you can work out where they are. And if you've got a subscription, then you can probably look at their tastes and things like that and place the right ads in front of them. So it's evolving very fast. And all these things come back and hit linear services just because of the proliferation. But much of it looks just like TV as we've known it for the past 30 years. FAST is really a technology and a bit of a business model. It's not really something that's particularly different to you as a consumer.
So what is new for TV then? What has been driving, if it just replacing, the vast majority, just replacing. One thing I've noticed, and I've noticed this a lot, and this year especially in terms of TV manufacturers and what it is that they're shouting about the loudest, and that's gaming. Suddenly TV manufacturers are realizing, well, actually, that we've got this huge market here that we really need to be appealing to. So is that a driver? Is it something that people are looking at the TVs to do for them, or are those that really care actually just going to go and get a display monitor anyway and not really that bothered about the TV?
Great question, Phil, because I think one of the things we've seen right the way across video products, so TVs and also monitors, is people have discovered segmentation of their product range. If you think about TVs 10 years ago, then you had cheap basic ones at the bottom, big fancy ones with better performance at the top, and that was about it. But what you see now is a growing targeting of TVs for certain things. So, for some while we've had design-centric TVs, for example, like Samsung's Frame and Serif type products. And of course, other brands have done similar things. But now people are saying, well, that's actually going to look at a particular niche. And we saw it in monitors that people started producing gaming monitors. And it's now happening in TVs. Also, of course, if you're making OLEDs and you're really committed to the OLED market, gaming is one area where OLED has some innate advantages in terms of its very, very fast response times and things like that, being an impulse-driven device. So yes, the TV business has discovered segmentation, and certainly there's a group of TVs that are now really tightly focused on addressing all those things that you've been complaining about for 15 years, like, for example, too much frame storage, which leads to a laggy TV. I think we've got to be a little bit careful because at the same time, if you are a really hardcore gamer and you're going to spend £1,000 on a graphics card, then at the same time you're going to have a PC, and you'll probably have the special chair, and you'll be actually using it like a desktop with a monitor. So the TV is probably a bit mid-range because it's linked much more to consoles. But definitely, it's part of the market. And maybe it's the reason that dad goes out and buys the OLED because the kids will really enjoy it with a PlayStation, won't they? And it could be a stealth sale or something like that. But definitely, the industry is beginning to segment rather than just do sort of straight linear product ranges. And I think we'll see more of it.
And do we still see the surge in TV sales, things like the Euros, Wimbledon? We've got the Olympics this year as well, the World Cup. Do you still see the spikes in people going out and buying TVs?
Oh yeah. Whenever we do our forecasts, we always work on the principle that even numbered years have slightly larger numbers overall in the first half of the year compared to odd numbered years. Whether that's really about demand or whether it's just about there's so much noise and promotion, and you see adverts on the TV or outdoors when you're moving around is a question. For the overall years, it bumps it very slightly. At the same time, people tend to get a bit overexcited, and then you have an inventory correction later in the year as everybody has to empty out their warehouses. And the worst example was some years back in the Euros when Germany, the TV sales were going gangbusters. Then Germany came out, got kicked out of the Euros really early, and suddenly the whole market just just crack as everybody went off on holiday instead of watching the next few rounds. So you have to be, and manufacturers are sitting on a whole load of inventory because they'd expected them to get to at least the semi-finals. So it's a dangerous game, and but overall, we normally find that the major sports events do bump it a little bit, but maybe it's more about promotion than real demand.
So let's kind of try and summarize everything that we've been talking about for almost an hour now. Where are we? What is the big development this time around? Where is the market going? And is it healthy?
I think we've been at the time where we've seen the industry look over the edge several times now. You know, that you carry on cutting prices and faster than your costs, and that takes you to ruin. Where we are is that there's a renewed level of competition as Chinese brands, especially TCL and Hisense, now are absolutely in the top draw in terms of shipments, and they can compete on technology. And they're also spending huge amounts of money on marketing. So there's renewed brand competition. There's a whole new category of the XXL sizes, 85 inch and up, which is totally new for consumers, and we'll wait and see what they think about that. There's renewed display technology with mini LED, which again threatens to mix that up a bit. And we always come back to that thing as consumers is, do you spend your money on going big, or do you spend your money on going better? And that's adding certainly a new dimension. It is still a market that's driven by technology, and that tends to be about big changes in format from CRT to LCD or digital broadcast. And there, I think we're seeing stability. And the final one is that actually the fundamental business model of TV is, do you make money out of hardware or do you make money out of services, is now something where it's something that brands and platforms have a part to play in that, which they've never had before.
Yeah. So we did a quick poll, completely unscientific. I have to point this out. We had quite a few respondents, but it's a very small sample poll. So just bear that in mind while we go through this. But we kind of got the results we were expecting from the AV Forum's audience. So question number one was, are targeted adverts on your smart TV OS acceptable if the revenue helps TV companies remain solvent and able to innovate? 30% of you said yes, and a whopping 70% of you, at the time of this podcast, by the way, because these results will vary because it's still live, 70% said no. I don't think we're expecting anything different here, were we, Paul?
Probably not, and it would be interesting to know whether the 30% who said yes were mainly in the US, where people are much more comfortable with advertising. But yeah, it's a dangerous game, as I think we said.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to hear that one plays out. I know some manufacturers are a bit hesitant. They see the business model, but they also see the pitfalls. And it's going to be interesting to see how they handle that and their approach to that. Certainly in Europe, I think in the US, like you say, consumers are a bit more used to being sold to like that. So question number two, are you planning on buying an 85-inch plus TV in the next 2 years? I think this is a big, literally big question to ask. Because this is where everybody's predicting that the big growth is going to be. So surprisingly, 84% said no, they're not interested in 85 inch or above in the next 2 years. Only 3%, and again, this is at the time of this podcast, own 85 inch or above. And 13% said they would be interested in that size of TV. So how does that equate to some of the figures that you're seeing,
Oh,
Paul?
that's way, way higher. You know,
Okay.
I think we're talking about, one percent of the market, maybe, maybe 2 or 3% of the market. It would be an absolutely extreme level. So I think that shows that, as you expected, your members are far more engaged and far more willing to spend. Which doesn't surprise me, they're power users.
And again, another interesting question, but I think this maybe reflects some of the wider audience out there as well. But on average, which of the following do you use to consume the most of your TV media? And linear was 21%, catch up 9%, and streaming 70%. Again, another mix of across the board there. And again, I've got to stress that these figures are non-scientific. It's not a great big pool of people, and it will vary from the polls that we run on X as well as on our YouTube channel. There were slight differences there as well. Not huge, couple of percent here and there. But in general, well, how does that equate to what you're seeing in the actual mass market?
Yeah, the fascinating one is that if you talk to a CE industry audience, or you talk to a media industry audience especially, then they believe that everybody's watching streaming all the time and nothing else. In reality, when you add in all the rest of us, of the consumers, then people watch less than an hour of streaming a day, even in the, the UK or the US. So, you do have to be careful that streaming is still a minority in terms of the total hours viewed. But it is changing very fast. And I think that, of course, AV Forum's members are hyper engaged, early adopting on technologies, very internet savvy, and you, and as you would expect, would be much more engaged with it and leading the charge.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, one of the big plus points with streaming technology, it's getting so good now in terms of bit rates and everything else and the technology. You get HDR, Dolby Vision, Dolby Atmos sound, and so on nowadays, from a lot of these service providers like Disney Plus and Netflix and so on. So, the experience can be fantastic if you pay for the premium
Yeah, to give an
subscriptions.
example, watching the Euros at the weekend, then I switched from live terrestrial to streaming. Why? Because then I got HDR.
Yeah.
So that suddenly registers me as a streaming audience, and I'd have been quite happy watching on terrestrial, but because the streaming offered extra
Yeah.
and more for something, then of course I switched to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paul, thank you very much for answering the questions today. It's been fascinating. I know people are going to have questions that they maybe have. So we'll maybe need to do a revisit towards the end of the year or maybe into the new year. But certainly, if people have got questions at the minute, then you can submit them to us, podcast@avforums.com on the email, or you can put your comments below if you're watching on YouTube. Or if you can go to AV Forums, go all the way down to the bottom of the forum list, you'll find a podcast forum. Find the thread relating to this podcast and ask your question in there. And our producer, Andy, will go through and he collates all of the questions so we can come back and answer them in future podcasts. And I'm going to do that right now, very quick Q&A comments. So one was from the LG interview with James Thomas back on the 8th of April. Invisible Kid said, "I admit, Dolby Vision filmmaker seems appealing. It's basically Dolby Vision Dark, but renamed filmmaker. So that is the most ideal if you want to watch in dim surroundings, as it was intended to be seen with the correct grayscale color and so on. Then Dolby Vision filmmaker is definitely the mode for you. And the fact that LG are now doing that is a nice touch." From YouTube, there was quite a few questions all along the same kind of lines. About the remote control, it was something I've been complaining about for a number of years now. It's a big plastic black thing with no backlight and so on. And if you're spending 3 or 4 thousand pounds on a TV, you expect something a little bit better than that. So hopefully LG will come up with something that can work with that. The newer remotes will work with the new TVs, but older remotes don't tend to work. They have slightly different coding. So you can't just go and buy a premium remote from a few years ago on an LG TV and expect it to work. They won't quite do that. And then Barbara Bab, I'm hoping I'm saying that right. Why do LG insist on fixed mains cables? It's just stupid. No other brand does this. I suppose if you are wall mounting your TV, that can be an issue because it's a set length and so on. It's certainly feedback that we will put back to LG on that one. Just quickly, from the Sony interview with Gavin McCarron back on the 13th of May, Murphy says that in the US, the A95L is definitely being touted as still as the flagship Sony TV, and the Bravia 9 the step under. Whereas in Europe, it's the other way around, and that seems to be how the market is working there. Again, Sony, huge company, they all have their own little subsidiary companies that cover each section of the planet. They do tend to have slightly different priorities when it comes to model numbers, but both models are continuing this year, as Gavin said in that interview. The A95L for the QD-OLED is the flagship OLED TV, and the Bravia 9 is the new mini LED TV. And if you get a chance to see it, it's not in the shops just yet, but if you get the chance to go and see one, go and see it. I'm really impressed. Can't wait to get the review sample through for that. And there was a few other comments in there. I'm not going to read them all out at the minute, but thank you very much for taking the time to put your comments in there. And yeah, where it comes to a lot of the mini LED technology, a lot of you seem to be quite interested to see how that's going to work with their new backlight technology. And of course, the color, volume, and everything else that you get from the mini LED TVs. And then finally, the TCL interview with Marek, that was the last TV podcast on the 10th of June. Pulse One said they really enjoyed the podcast, bigger screen sizes, and also prices coming down. We'd fully agree with Jules that you only get the full immersion with a projector and an acoustic screen. And of course, that is a problem with these big screen TVs. Where do you put your center channel? If it's filling the whole wall, you can't shove it behind the screen like you can with a projector screen and so on. But then the flip of the coin there is the projector can't compete with the TV when it comes to HDR and Dolby Vision and so on. So yeah, you've got to pick your poison there when it comes to the sizes of the TVs. And THX 1138 UK said, very interesting. The size of panels and the peak brightness is very impressive, and things are becoming more affordable all the time, which is great. But no way can flat panels beat a projected image for movies in a dedicated home cinema room. And this is the argument that's now happening amongst enthusiasts. It's great to see, because I'm with you on both of them. I can't choose. You watch a projected image, it's filmic, it's movie-like, it's a reflected image. You feel like you're at the cinema, and a cinema, it doesn't go for 50 nits. Your high dynamic range, I think you can push 102, I think is what Dolby say, or 104. Then you get the fixed panel TV though, and you get that HDR immersiveness, specular highlight detail and that kind of thing. It can look amazing as well. So yeah, I'm kind of on the fence with this one. I can't choose whether it's big screen and so on. So THX 1138 UK, thank you very much for your comments there. Current competitions, very quickly, we've got hardware competitions open. You can win a streaming system worth £2,400. That is the Roxanne Atessa integrated streaming amplifier and monitor audio Silver 107G bookshelf speakers. It closes at 11:15 9 p.m. on Wednesday, August the 28th. So get yourself in for that one. You can also wear a pair of Q Acoustics M40 powered micro tower speakers and a pair of QED digital cables worth a total of £1,069. We recently reviewed those and awarded them 10 out of 10 best in class. Well, they are cracking speakers. That competition opened till July the 31st at 11:59 p.m. And all competitions are open to eligible AV Forums members over 18 and who are resident in the UK. So head over to avforums.com/competitions for that. And don't forget, we've also got lots of disc competitions over there. I'm not going to read them out at the moment because there's loads of them. But you can win Blu-rays, DVDs, and 4K discs. That's available to patrons and, of course, AV Forums members as well. And it's the same address for that. We don't seem to have any new patrons or bought us a coffees this time around, but we will mention you next time. So yeah, if you are thinking about a patron, or we have also introduced an annual membership, go and check all that out, and any support you can give is always appreciated. So that's it for the TV display and calibration edition of the podcast. Our next podcast is the Home AV edition on Monday the 15th of July, and of course these episodes are always available from 7 p.m. on the AV Forums podcast YouTube channel, so go and subscribe to that channel so you never miss one. And thanks again to Paul, it's great to see you on the podcast. We'll get you back some other time, but great to see you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Phil.
So I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll catch you in the next one. Goodbye.